Hey, let's head up the meeting. We better move all our bills quick. Nobody here.
Good morning, Ernie. Good morning.
Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier. Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty. Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer. Kreisel. Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran. Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Present.
Smith.
Okay, take an amendment to approve the minutes from March 17th, or a motion, excuse me. Representative Nordis moves the minutes of March 17th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Okay, up today. First on the order is our omnibus finance bill, House File 853. I'm going to move the bill myself, put it in front of the committee, and today what we'll be doing is we'll be going over the bill, and I'll be presenting it from the chair position here, and we will take public testimony after we do a walkthrough of the fiscal portion and then the language and questions and public testimony. And then I believe the amendments are due today at 5 p.m. And the page has a sign-up sheet for anybody that would like to testify. And then the amendments due at 5, and then we convene tomorrow.
Upstairs at 5.
What's that?
Upstairs to the revising. I mean, to the research area.
Okay. The amendments upstairs to the researcher by 5, correct? Sounds good. Okay. House File 853 is in front of us. What I'd like to do is... I'd like to move the DE3 amendment to the House file, and just to get it in the form we want it. Without objection, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, House file is in front of us with the DE3 amendment, and we're going to start out with Mr. Carter giving us a walkthrough of the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think you all have the spreadsheet in front of you. And basically what we will be doing when on this overview, we will be going through the chair's recommendations. We won't be discussing base or anything like that, just the change items. And before I start, I should say that the target was a little over $30 million in reductions that this committee had to make. We also, if the committee wanted to, there was the one-time funding for corrections at around $27 million that was done 2 years ago, and it was a federal stimulus package, and it was only one time. And also with the disaster program, that is almost a must to do for funding because it matches 75% federal grants. So basically the total that the chair in this committee had to come up with in reductions or revenue offsets was over $58 million. So with that, members, we'll start with the spreadsheet, and we'll start on public safety, page one, and it's Homeland Security is the first program under public safety. And here we have on line seven, the disaster assistance match. The governor had a recommendation of a little over $2 million for this. The House recommendation is $1.226 million. What the House, or the chair's recommendation, I should say, is that we are only funding the state chair. There's 75% federal funding and 25%, and of that 25%, we are funding 15% of that. So we are just funding, the chair's recommendation is just to fund the state share.
Mr. Carter, I forgot to say that we'd like to go through the spreadsheet and the language before we take any questions, if that's okay with you, Representative Mullery. Okay, if we go through the spreadsheet and the language and then take questions?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Carter.
The next program under the Department of Public Safety is the BCA. You see here the governor had zero reduction. The chair's recommendation is a $1.2 million reduction for the biennium, and that reduction translates into about a 1.48% reduction to the BCA. Next program under public safety is the fire marshal. And here, you'll see this later on in the revenue adjustments, but the chair is recommending that the balance that the fire count has, it's the balance is between 8 and 9 million, that the chair is recommending 8.5 million of that fund go to the general fund to help offset the deficit. Page two of the spreadsheet, you'll see on the next, on line 35, the next program under public safety is alcohol and gambling enforcement. And the chair is going along with the governor's recommendation on this program. It's basically base funding, no reductions. The next program on line 45 is the Office of Justice Programs. Here there's two change items here. First one the governor recommended was the Network for Better Futures at 2.9. The chair's recommendation is zero, but the chair has also recommended that they apply for burn grants and through the Office of Justice Programs. On line 50, here we have an overall reduction of 17.5% to the Office of Justice Programs. This translates to about a $12 million reduction for the biennium. And there will be a rider saying that battered women's programs should take no more than an 11% reduction of that. The next program is Emergency Communications Network. That starts on line 56 of the spreadsheet. Here you have armor maintenance and operation. Operations, this was a governor's recommendation of $6.83 million for the biennium. The chair is recommending that. The chair is also recommending a balance transfer to the general fund. There is a balance of about $5.2 million in this fund. The chair is recommending that this be transferred to the general fund to, once again, help offset the reductions. Page three of the spreadsheet. We'll start off on line 71. We have the Peace Officers Board, commonly known as the Post Board. And here we have the governor has recommended an operation reduction and a grant reduction. They both totaled about $400,000 for the biennium. The chair is recommending a reduction of $450,000. However, that reduction will only be coming from grant reductions, not from the operations or the central office. Next agency that this committee is responsible for is the Private Detective Board on line 80. Here the chair is going along with the governor's recommendations. There is no change. It basically is base funding for this agency. On line 85 is the Department of Human Rights. Here the chair is recommending a reduction of about 65%, and that translates to about a $4.34 million reduction for the biennium. The next agency, our largest agency that this committee has supervision over, is Corrections, and we start off with the first program under Corrections. And we have that the first one on line 97 is the Restore TALES from the federal one-time funding. Chair agrees with the governor on this, $26.948 million for the biennium. On line 98 is the continuation of the CD treatment at Faribault Hospital. They appear Corrections had a federal grant that is expiring. The chair's recommendation is no new appropriation. However, I believe after talking to the chair that they can apply for federal grants on this also or find internal funding for this. The next item is the operating budget reduction. This was the governor's recommendation, and that is at $800,000 for the biennium. The chair is agreeing with that reduction of $800,000 for the biennium. The next line is 100 on the spreadsheet, and this is the short-term offenders. You'll remember that the original bill had 180 days or less. The chair's recommendations is 60 days or less. They will stay at the local jail or workhouse. And that translates into a savings of about $1.3 million for the biennium. On line 101, the next decision item or change item is the retirement changes. This was discussed the other day in committee, and this is removing the non-correctional officers from the correctional pension plan. And this translates into a savings of about $914,000 for the biennium. The next two lines on 102 and 103 title these institutional efficiencies, reductions, performance, and innovations. And here you'll see Mr. Diebel will be going through a rider that's fairly detailed that will be covering earned compliance credit, limiting prison revocations, some federal items for the REPAT program, the ICE REPAT program. And the overall reduction here is $15.9 million for the biennium. However, if you note on the spreadsheet under the chair's recommendation that the majority of that reduction will take place in the second year in 2013, giving the agency and some of the working groups time to develop a strategy to see if this can be done. The next change item is line 104 on the spreadsheet. This is the inmate health care copay, where the chair is recommending an increase from $3 to $5. This will result in a slight savings of about $70,000 for the biennium. Page 4, we have community services on line 111. This is another program under the Department of Corrections. Here, the operating budget reduction, the governor had recommended at $632,000 for the biennium. The chair is also recommending that reduction. The governor also had a supervision reduction. This is to the probation, the three probation systems. I think it was about a 2.5% reduction. The governor or the chair is recommending less than that. The chair is recommending a $2.84 million reduction. That's about $290,000 less than what the governor's recommendation was. And then on line 116, elimination of the sex offender grant program. This was the pilot program for Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted County. It results in a savings of $276,000 for the biennium. The governor had this recommendation, and as is the chair's recommendation. The last program in the Department of Corrections is Operation Support. Here, the governor had a recommendation on line 126 of $670,000. The chair's recommendation is $1.79 million, and there will be riders also that Mr. Diebel will be addressing this change. So the last page, members, I just want to go through the revenue adjustments. The revenue adjustments basically help offset the target. And the first one you see there is the one I discussed previously is the transfer from the fire safety account to the general fund, resulting in an $8.5 million in savings. The post board reduction to general fund, $450,000. This is done because the post is a special revenue fund, and any savings that the committee takes will have to be will go to the general fund. On line 152 is the transfer from the state government special revenue fund. This is the armor fund that had the balance, and the chair is recommending $2.6 million each year be taken for a total of $5.2 million. And this is one time. And I should also point out that the fire marshal is only a one-time transfer. On line 153 is Mint Corps. They have a revolving fund. The chair is recommending there a transfer that they, and they have a slight balance in that, taking part of that balance, $1.2 million. Once again, this will only be a one-time transfer. And then the last one is on line 154. The DOC has some special revenue accounts. They have some balances in them. The chair is recommending $800,000 from those funds go to the general fund. And you can see on the spreadsheet on that the totals there on 159 and 160 is the additional of the federal of the disaster, the fiscal year disaster for this year. The total is $1,025,818,000, and that is our target. And you will see over and under target at the line 164 at zero. And that is the spreadsheet, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter. I think we'll move right into the language of the DE3 with Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair?
No. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, could we ask specific questions? Like there's a Mr. Carter said that he said 11% of that reduction to OGP, is it 11% of the reduction or is it a max of 11% of their funding?
You're on line
50 and 51.
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, the rider, and Curious is just showing me the rider. It's the commissioner may not reduce grants to domestic abuse shelters more than 11% from their base.
Okay, that's what I thought,
right.
But you said the opposite.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative
Duffy? That answers my question.
And Mr. Diebel on the language.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll walk through the DE3 amendment and Article 1, I'll highlight where the language is different from the traditional riders contained in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. The first change from prior years you can find on page 4, line 9, and that's the rider that was just discussed regarding domestic abuse shelters under the Office of Justice Programs. And again, it simply states the commissioner may not reduce grants to domestic abuse shelters more than 11% from the base. The next rider that deviates from the boilerplate riders is found on the bottom of page 5, and that's line 31 to 33, and that's a $2.6 million transfer each year from the armor fund to the general fund. The next rider I'd like to highlight is found on page 6, line 19, under the Department of Human Rights. It's entitled Mission Priority. It's a statement that reads, "The Commissioner shall dedicate the Department's resources to enforcement measures." Moving to the Department of Corrections, there are several riders under the subdivision correctional institutions. Starting on page 7, line 4, there's a rider that directs, gives guidance to the commissioner as to position reductions that may be needed to implement the cut to the department. On line 7.13, there's a report requested from or ordered from the department regarding the reduction in the per diem of medical per diem for inmates by 5%. So there's a directive to the commissioner to cut the medical per diem by 5% and then to report to the legislature the results of that initiative. On line 7.26, there's a rider regarding the state's juvenile facilities, and it asks the Commissioner of Corrections to study the continued operation of the facilities and if there are better uses for those or whether they should be continue to be operated by the state at all. And again, a report is required from the commissioner to the legislature. Moving to page 8, line 12, There's a reform working group and a report required. This is the one that Mr. Carger referenced regarding reform initiatives, and you can see, starting on line 8.15, the areas that the Commissioner of Corrections and the working group are tasked to explore as perhaps options for saving, and they include an earned credit program, the federal REPAT program for illegal immigrants housed in our prisons, expanding the use of medical and early release, and the feasibility of closing or a wing or an entire facility, or in the alternative, renting any vacant space that perhaps arises from the short-term offenders being housed in local jails and using that space for offenders from other states. Moving now to the subdivision community services on page 9, there's a rider there that directs the Commissioner of Corrections to explore probation revocation reform. That's on line 27 of page 9. And that's an effort to, again, implement the year 2 cut to the department and perhaps reduce the number of probation revocations that are sent to the Department of Corrections, and thereby lowering the number of inmates in the facilities. Again, that requires a report to the legislature and some detailed areas for examination by the commissioner. The next rider I'd like to highlight is on page 10 under operations support. It's line 30. This is a similar rider to the one under correctional institutions regarding position reductions. It directs the commissioner to make at least 50% of the reductions in operations support must come from the elimination of a reduction in benefits for management positions, and it gives guidance as to where the commissioner should look for positions that don't go to the department's core mission of public safety and promoting the safety of line officers. That's the those are the change from previous years in Article 1. I'd like to move to Article 2, which is found on page 11, starting on line 27. Section 1 is the chair's bill on increasing the co-payment for inmate medical care from $3 to $5. Section 2 on page 12 is a conforming amendment to reflect the transfer of funds from the fire safety account to the general fund in the next 2 fiscal years. Sections 3 and 4 are taken from the chair's human rights reform bill, and these, if you'll recall, relate to reducing the mandates on the Department of Human Rights and otherwise limiting some of their responsibilities. Sections on page 14, section 5, 6, and 7 are the taken directly from the, they are from the chair's short-term offender bill. As introduced, that called for 180 days, offenders with 180 days or less to serve their time in local jails. The version that's contained in the delete all amendment is limited to 60 days. So if you have 60 days or less, you will serve your time in a local jail. On page 15, section 8 is the chair's House File 6 on, as amended in committee. It's the indeterminate sentence for predatory sex offenders. The one change item from that bill as it was last heard in committee is that the effective date on that provision is July 1, 2013. Section 9 on page 17, line 33, this is a provision that would push the in-service training on police pursuits from every 4 years to every 5 years, with cost savings to training for local law enforcement. Section 10 on page 18 is a provision that would allow county jails to reimburse medical providers at the medical assistance payment rate. for services provided to jail inmates. This is a program that was initially made available to Anoka County, and the other counties have requested the similar authority under statute, and this provision, Section 10, would grant those counties that authority. Section 11 on page 19 is the Sex Offender Policy Task Force. This is a chair's initiative, and it lists the areas for the task force to examine and to report back to the legislature. Those are found on page 19, line 9 through line 21, and it's intended to be a broad and comprehensive look at the sex offender policy and programs in the state. The membership is listed on line 24 of page 19. And then section 12, page 20, line 16, is a repealer that is also taken from the chair's human rights reform bill. Article 3 is simply the chair's bill on correctional employee pensions and medical retiree benefits. And that is sections 1 through 5 of that article. And that's the bill.
Okay. That's the spreadsheet and the language. Questions from members? And then we'll get into the testimony after that. Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is, I don't really care when. I was just wondering if the council have, some people raised the issue of whether we could take that armor tax, which was specific, and whether that's valid to do that. I don't know. I have no idea. And maybe either council could answer it or possibly look it up sometime before tomorrow.
I probably could give you an answer now, as much as I could, as much as we know, is that it's an ongoing discussion, and we disagree with the advice we've got. And we're continuing to ask questions and get a determination, but yeah, there is some concern about that, and we just can't see how this small of an amount of money in the overall budget scheme could affect the rating like that, and so we're still asking questions, and at present it's in the bill. And then I should comment before we get going too much further. I forgot I was going to make comments, but the budget process, you folks have known, has been put out on the website. It was really tough getting here, and as we go through this process, there's going to be comments made about robbing Peter to pay Paul, and this, we don't have a spending problem, we got a revenue problem, and vice versa, and things like this. We admittedly had to take from accounts that we really didn't want to sometimes and put into other accounts because we prioritize within this budget. This thing's buzzing at me. And it's just something that we had to do, and desperate times have unfortunately called for desperate measures, and there's some areas we wouldn't have gone to, some that we actually, I don't know if you'd call it look forward to be going to, but have looked at for some time about the problems with the funding levels and the policies. So it was a real mixture. We've gotten some, I think, good ideas from Representative Johnson and Mullery on probation over the with their thoughts on it, and we're trying to work that way in some of the efficiencies in the studies into that, and so we give them credit. And through here you'll see various policy changes. One thing about this bill that you'll notice, and especially our DFL members, is that there's really not policy in it. The only policy, can you turn this thing down so it doesn't buzz back at me? It's aggravating. And there's only policy in here that effectuated change in the fiscal. And so we've tried to, even the bills that I would like to of my own, if they cost any money, we didn't put them in. If there was a prison bed space, we tried not to burden corrections and the courts and the public defenders. So we tried to curb back on, and we naturally would like to, in some cases, increase sentences and lock people up, but we balance that against the cost that we're pushing on beyond us to the public defenders and the courts and corrections. And so we tried to come up with a common sense, and there was some bills that we just left out that you'll notice here. and some things that we wanted to do that we had plans on and introductions for. And there's still a lot of time to do policy. By no means are we forgetting policy. In case that comes up with our members, that we've got a lot of time left after we push this budget on and through the process. So naturally, I'd like to thank my staff for helping out. And some of the things that we, you know, like I said, we really didn't want to do, but sometimes you have to. And with that, we're going to have a very transparent process here. We're not going to rush through this. We're going to give the DFL side, as long as and our own members in the GOP, plenty of time to answer questions. We've allowed for public testimony. We're going to take public testimony again. Anybody that has a problem with any area of the budget is welcome to come to the table and express their concerns. I would say that it, to save you probably some trouble on that side, is the general direction I'd like to go is, I know there's been a request for task forces. I'd kind of like to keep that to a minimum. We already got task force and working groups in here, and the only one I really put in was try to is the ones that would affect a change in the fiscal policy of the bill. So what we did, we kind of wanted to allow with the task force. And so if you have task force ideas on the table, I would appreciate it if you would try to do it like we didn't have no cost, limit the per diem expense so there's no cost. Then we could do it as policy and bring them up later in policy instead of trying to interject them into this bill. But that's, you can still offer an amendment, but I'm just telling you, I would rather you have it, hold it until later and consider it in the policy measure and give it a full look through then. So, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm in two places at one time, although it doesn't look like it, but there's another committee that's meeting across the way that I need to be at as well. So I just want to ask this very quickly, but I will come in and out. So on the chair's sharing of policy limited or primarily limited to the fiscal year, I note that there is policy on mission priority for Department of Human Rights. Is that limited to this appropriation then, or is that permanent statutory?
Which part?
That would be the Department of Human Rights mission priority language. That's on page 6, line 6.19 through 6.21.
So you're asking if that's limited to this biennium or if it extends on permanent?
That's correct, Mr.
It'd be in my intention to leave it in there as permanent.
All right, so Mr. Chair, so that is permanent policy that's being proposed. And then I know we're going to hear from lots of folks and we'll have an ongoing discussion, but I just want to note, Mr. Chair, at this point, and I do appreciate the tough task that chairs, finance chairs face and, in terms of meeting the targets that they've been handed. But I think it's important to note, in OJP, we have a 17.5% cut in Post Board, a 5.6% BCA, 1.4%, and Battered Women not to exceed 11%. And then we jump over to the Department of Human Rights, and it's 65% cut. It seems incredibly outsized compared to the other cuts. And so I guess the question really is, you know, what is the message that this committee then is sending to the public in regards to the Department of Human Rights and in regards to the promise of human rights that our U.S. the state constitution extends to its citizens? What is the, it's just a question that jumps out at you in terms of the incredible discrepancy of outsized cut to one department relative to what else is happening in our accounts.
Representative Mariani and members, this question will probably come up again. It does stick out because it's such a large cut, but after listening to the testimony to the human rights, they never really had a good explanation, it seems like, for some of the answers to some of our questions. And it seems like the areas that they were directed in or what their mission was could be cut back. And there was a duplication. I got the word right this time, Representative Gothier. And let me read you something. It doesn't take long. Here's some research that we did. And this would probably answer this question and maybe help out other people understand it. It says the services of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights are available to all Minnesotans. Citizens of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth also have access to similar departments in those cities. Under a work share agreement with the United States Equal Opportunity Commission, complaints in which both agencies have jurisdiction are cross-filed but will only be investigated by one agency. All citizens of Minnesota may access the MDHR services via toll-free, including TTY, walk-in, and email. MDHR staff includes fluent Hmong Spanish speakers and will provide interpreter services when needed. Citizens have also access to federal services. The Housing Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity has toll-free lines and accepts complaints online. The Civil Rights Department or Division of the U.S. Department of Justice accepts complaints by mail but has a toll-free telephone line. The Department of Justice investigates complaints related to discrimination on the basis of disability, except with regards to employment, and those are investigated by the EEOC. Citizens may access EEOC services via toll-free telephone, walk-in, or regional office, but may only file charges by mail or in person. EEOC provides an online assessment tool for persons considering filing a complaint. According to the MDHR website, employment-related charges consistently make up the bulk of their work, and 63% of all charges are filed in calendar year 2010. Further, most of the areas were made on the basis of disability. As the significant federal resources are available in these areas, the legislature should explore where other eligible cases can be handled at the federal level, since the federal budget does not need to be balanced, it seems like. Long and the short of it is we think that there's enough resources available to take the complaints, and that's why we redirected their mission and didn't take it away. They're still there and operating. We just redirected the education and outreach programs. That's as good an answer as I can give. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the forethought that you shared here. And I suspect we'll have a conversation as we go forward with the bill with others here. I do think it's important that if we're going to depend on other levels of government to take up whatever slack we're either unwilling or unable to do, that we engage with those levels of government to assess their willingness and their ability to carry that as well. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Take a break just a second to the students visiting today are from the Heritage Christian Academy, if we could give them a hand. Thank you for being here. You picked a good day.
Well,
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, and we'll have further conversations, but with regard to the task forces, I know I submitted three. One of them's on the same topic as yours, except more explicit and covers things that I think need to be done, and all three of them do directly affect the budget and what we might either save or run into as more problems next year. So I think that it really those three at least are make sense to put in the budget bill, because they all affect, just like you said, the sex offender work group affects the budget. The other two also do. So we can talk about that before finalizing the bill.
Okay, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the Department of Human Rights and duplication. And I want to make it clear, just because the City of Duluth has a human rights office doesn't mean there's duplication. The city's human rights office has no enforcement power. So they basically are limited to housing complaints through a HUD grant. So we have to be careful when we make these comparisons. And I'm not quite sure what the others, when we talk about educating on human rights, who are we shipping that out to? Because I'm not quite sure that we're doing that at all. I think we're eliminating it. But who are we asking to pick that up to educate the people on human rights?
These folks are still there. It seemed like at this point, in these budget times, we didn't need to be going out and putting on these type of education programs. and it's about the best explanation I can give. It was our determination that they could be cut back 65%, and we took away the mandate to do the education and outreach.
So, Mr. Chair, what we're really saying is there will be no outreach or education.
I could probably try to find out some of the places in the websites or other places that would be available for that.
I would appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Mullery.
There is still the requirement of compliance in other areas of the statute, which we couldn't take away in this committee because they're not under our jurisdiction. So, and I know that, for instance, Minneapolis and St. Paul don't have, and Duluth for sure, doesn't have anything to do with this contract's compliance for state agencies. So obviously that has to go on, and some of this doesn't just affect that. The one repealer that you did is actually a big help for businesses, so the chamber may even be concerned about that part. So hope you'll, as we go along and hear more testimony, reconsider some of the things done to the Human Rights Department. I think they're necessary things, and in some cases the businesses want them too.
Okay, yeah, we'd be interested in anything you have to tell us. Any other questions? Okay, got public testimony lined up, and let me see who's on our list. I don't know how to pronounce the name, but Stephanie from the Alliance on Crime and General Crime OJP grants. Are you here? If you could give us your name and who you'd be representing, and then go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Zugswort. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Alliance on Crime, formerly known as the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition. My organization is a statewide General Crime Victim Coalition. And we have generally 60 to 70 members statewide, and we've been in existence since 1993. The majority of the General Crime Victim Service providers are located within the criminal justice system. And they're mainly in county attorney's offices, law enforcement offices, as well as some community nonprofits. I'm here to testify on behalf, and just basically I'm happy to be here to educate you about what general crime victim service providers do, distinguish them from the other crime victim service providers that are in Minnesota, and answer any questions if you have that. I see that the recommendation from the chair is to cut Office of Justice Programs 17.5%. Unclear as to how that will end up in terms of crime victim service budgets, but I still take this opportunity to be here to educate you. General crime victim services provide services to victims of a category of crime that's called general crime. What that means is really just every crime that there is out there. 39 different crimes in total, including homicide, financial scams, robbery, arson, assault, identity theft, stalking, drunk driving, just to name a few. They also, general crime victim service providers also provide services for sexual assault, child abuse, and domestic violence victims as well. Just a few statistics. General crime victim service providers last year served 28,054 victims. 52.9% of these victims were female, 47% of them were male. Domestic violence programs served 26,197 victims, 90% of these were female. Sexual assault programs served 8,084 victims, and 88% of these were female. I just wanted to point out, last week I was here when... Can I hand out, Mr. Chair, a handout for the committee?
Why don't you give us a copy up here at the chair spot here, and let me look at it first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's my understanding, are you all testifying on the same subject?
Basically, yes, same subject, just different points of view. I have Stephanie Beckman here, who's Meeker County attorney, so she's to speak about the effectiveness and importance of the crime victim advocates in her office and to the system, criminal justice system in general. Mary Harder's here is from Waseca Police Department. She's a crime victim advocate, general crime victim advocate for the county of Waseca. And Kelly Nicholson from Dakota County. She's a crime victim advocate within Dakota County working under Jim Backstrom.
Okay, when you folks start, we're going to give you a very limited time because this isn't an overall budget hearing on your programs. This is input and how the cuts would affect you. So if you could keep it very short, we sure appreciate it. But where's the handout?
Okay, Mr. Chair. What I did,
okay,
I was here last week when you handed out this document that outlined every single crime victim service grant, office program grant. And what I did from that is just extract the data that is relevant to general crime victim programs and their budgets. Just to give you an idea as to the dire straits of the general crime victim service budgets, where they come from and what would happen if there would be a cut. Do you have that in front of you?
Okay. Your hand, yes, go ahead.
Okay, so basically my point is there are about 68 general crime victim programs in Minnesota. 63 of these are relying almost exclusively on the grants from Office of Justice Program. You can see from your sheet as you're getting it handed out, the average grant to our general crime victim programs is $43,000, with the largest being somewhere up around $80,000. This is enough basically to pay for one employee in each of these locations. Sometimes there's two. For the bigger counties, there's more. It clearly doesn't cover all of the program costs and the employee salary benefits, so it is a partnership generally between counties or law enforcement offices, community nonprofits, in order to cover the entire cost of the budget programs. Just another quick point, my general crime victim programs do not receive federal grants. They're not eligible in general under all of these grant programs that you listed in here. It looks like there's a ton of money in here. We're not getting it. What you see here on my spreadsheet is the budgets for my victim service provider. 17.5% cut, or what may end up will eliminate many of these offices, which is really a disservice to the general crime victim programs and the general crime victims in Minnesota. Maybe I'll stop there then and let my other people speak. Just
before you do, ma'am, how do you pronounce your last name again?
Zugschwert.
Yep. Are you saying that this column, that you don't receive any other state funding or any county funding or private funding, the grant in these columns would be your total funding from any resource? Or?
I was saying that in the event that these are housed in county attorney's office, we receive the my programs receive the $43,000 grant from OJP. They do have a partnership in general where the county will cover the other costs that may be needed above the $43,000. That really just comes down to sometimes it's benefits, sometimes it's office space, program costs. These do not even cover the one position. So no, we do not. You know, as you can see from your document you passed out, there are many grant programs through federal and state, but they're targeted to specific types of issues, for example, domestic violence or shelters or juvenile programs. General crime programs are not eligible for those grants.
Our problem, and for those of you in the crowd too, on OJP programs, somehow this program got away from us in that it was now considered a regular budget, and for many folks, it was never intended to be that. A grant is a grant. Once we start giving grants every year to every organization in the same amount, it turns into a budget, and then we have problems, and especially when that's their only source of funding. And unfortunately, the way the system is set up, that if people start depending on it, they depend on it for the future and probably shouldn't. And because we run into situations like this where we have to go to a certain area, you know, for the money, and then we end up in this situation. But now you're next testifier, or were you done?
Could I just speak quickly to your point? I appreciate, Mr. Chair. I think it was testified actually to the last time. It is a mandate under state statute 611A that crime victims are to receive certain rights, just as offenders are in the system. And so, in keeping with the state mandate, these funds are coming from the state, although they have come through the funding stream of a grant program, in recognition that we owe these obligations to the victims, and it is a state mandate. I'll stop there. Stephanie Beckman, Meeker County Attorney.
And if you folks, like I say, could keep it short, sometimes when we ask them to keep it short, they just go ahead and read three pages anyway, and that's not very short. All right, thank you. Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I'm Stephanie Beckman, Meeker County Attorney. I have no pages, so we don't have to worry about that. However, I do like to talk, so I'll keep it short and sweet. I am actually here to tell you that I'm representing more rural Minnesota. I believe you have the number in front of you on the Meeker County grant that's received through OJP for our one victim advocate. The one victim advocate is certainly not enough. I know that you are making tough decisions in tough times, as was already noted. So I'm here to actually talk more about how our victim advocate fits into the full schematic of the criminal justice system. The victim advocate is crucial. Not only is it a state mandate by law that the victim has rights, they also have appeal rights. Our office has to respond to those appeal rights. But let's move on and assume, for argument's sake, that we've made all our victims happy, and we're working with them through the criminal justice system. Whether or not a case is charged, there are victims out there of crimes. They believe they are victims of crimes. It may not be enough for a prosecutor to have to move forward in a charging decision for the court system. However, there is still a victim out there that requires services. And so, first and foremost, that's the intake that comes into our office. The victim advocate's role is not to be there to support the prosecution. It is there to support the victim. And so the next step is, let's assume a prosecution. Then we have other agencies that we're working alongside with in order to educate with our victim a very complex and very intimidating system. We are dealing with the courts. They have no idea, for the most part, hopefully, what types of hearings are occurring throughout the prosecution process, as well as what they mean and what the end result could be, depending on the type of hearing that is happening before or if there is a trial at hand. The court system relies heavily upon the victim advocate, not the prosecution, but the victim advocate to assist in witnesses and victims for any kind of court proceeding so that they're educated and that they are also feeling that that is the person that they use as a liaison to go to, so that the courts aren't inundated with victims standing up and speaking their minds throughout court proceedings because they don't understand that that isn't the process in which we act under. Lastly, law enforcement and court services, otherwise known as probation, plays a part in the process, assuming a conviction or an acquittal, in that we all work together with the victim and we unite. So the argument that's been made by, that I've heard anyway, Mr. Chair, is that, well, why not have these budgets just contained under the county attorney's office? I'm talking too much, aren't I?
Not too much.
The answer to that is that the counties are already strapped, and the victim advocates play a larger role than just a prosecutor. So there's the answer, and I'm done. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah. You say your name and title. Anybody else going to go? Oh, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name and representatives, my name is Kelly Nicholson. I am the supervisor of the Victim Witness Program in the office of James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney's Office. I've worked in the field of victim services for the past 16 years. Just to point out a couple of budget issues for our county, you will see in the grid handed out by Stephanie that our office receives a grant from the Office of Justice Program in the amount of $54,322. The overall budget for our victim witness program totals $351,000. So the $54,322 is just a portion. The rest of that comes from county levy and also from court administration, those fines and fees that are designated for victim services programs. I'd like to point out that the grid says that there are five FTEs in our program. One is for myself as a supervisor. Two are clerical staff. So only two positions are there as an advocate working directly with victims of crime. I'd like to point out that those two advocates alone for the year of 2010 served 2,705 victims. That, again, is just for the year of 2010, and that does not include victims for cases that were from prior calendar years that carried over as unresolved into 2010. I'd also like to point out that while crime trends are generally decreasing, for 2010, our violent crime rate was about 7% higher than in 2009. Therefore, our caseload and victim witness remained very high and relatively the same to 2009. One last comment, because I am cutting my three pages down significantly. There was an article written about our program in the Star and Tribune last November, and in response to that, one of the victims our program worked with submitted some comments of gratitude to the reporter for submitting that, and I'll just end with this. He explained that the people in victim services provide a vital service to those who have had bad people thrust into their lives and have done terrible things to them. I have thanked these women for helping me, but again, thank you for allowing the public to know how wonderful and dedicated these angels are to people going through bad situations. And those comments are not uncommon. We frequently receive words of praise and gratitude from the victims we serve. Therefore, I think that the money we receive from OJP is well spent, and certainly it would be extremely difficult for our office if we were to receive a cut, since we have two advocates and that money only covers a portion of one of those positions, which we would most likely lose if we were to lose funding. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am, go ahead and state your name. And
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Mary Harters. I work for the Waseca County General Crime Victims Office, which is out of the Waseca Police Department. They've had the grant since 1999, 2000, which they began after a child was murdered in Waseca. My program is unique in that I work with law enforcement very closely. I'm right in the same office as them, and that presents a very unique situation. I think that law enforcement has benefited from this program as well as the victims because of this, the closeness in working with the victims and law enforcement. For victims, it's easily accessible to get to the victim advocate, and they feel like law enforcement cares more about their situation because they're directly tying them to someone who has the ability to give them all these resources that an advocate does. And it gives them immediate attention during a crisis, whereas law enforcement has to get the facts and do the investigation. So advocates can be a direct link to aid in what law enforcement needs to do so that they're not tied up, you know, helping a victim and explain things. For law enforcement, it's an easy referral. Like I said, it frees up their time. They don't have to explain the process, what's going to happen next. They don't have to listen to the troubles that the crime has caused them in their personal life. They can say, I have someone here for you that will talk you through what's going to happen next. Thank you for the facts. If I need anything else, I'll come back to you. Advocates sometimes have information that they can help say to the victim. This is important for law enforcement to know. If you can give them this information, it will help in the investigation. So an advocate can be a link between law enforcement and the investigation, helping to prosecute crimes. And then that gives the law enforcement officer time to go and get the suspect. It, like I said, it gives them information they wouldn't have other times. I'm in court all the time. I see what happens. I know information about offenders. Maybe it's not even victim-related, but being in that situation, a law enforcement officer can say to me, you know, what's going on? And I say, well, that person has conditions of release or they're on probation. I'm a link for them. I'm information for them that they might not know otherwise because of my unique role. I know about orders for protection, harassment restraining orders, whether they're in place or whether they've been vacated. It's really a unique situation that law enforcement is really coming around to and seeing how helpful it can be. If my program sustains any cuts, there will no longer be a program and there will no longer be service to 963 victims that I served last year in Waseca County out of the 19,000 residents in that county. So it might be a smaller rural program, but they're still serving a large number of people that are affected by general crime that happens every day in their life. a victim of a bike theft can be just as traumatized as a victim who is murdered or raped. So I think it's important to not forget those other people that we deal with every day. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much, and I apologize if we took too long, but I appreciate the time.
No problem. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
I think what we're going to do is a small rule change here. if there's any other organizations that come up, just one spokesman, please. This was a very good presentation, but we haven't basically got the time with all the people that want to testify, and it would be unfair to the people behind them. So if you have an organization, just bring one person up and to represent your organization. Thank you, folks, for being here. Donna Dunn, the Coalition. And you kind of saw what the general time limit each one of them had. Just a couple minutes, that'd be great.
I have a handout.
And state thank your you. Name and title and go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Donna Dunn. I'm the director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And so, Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Mullery and members of the committee. I am pleased to be here to talk a little bit, very briefly, about the services of sexual assault advocacy programs that that serve our communities, victims, and survivors across the state. MnCASA is a membership program of 70 some member agencies made up of sexual assault advocacy programs and allied members across the state. I want to speak just briefly about what they do. Our sexual assault advocacy programs cover 74 of 87 of Minnesota's 87 counties and 6 of our 11 reservations. So as you can see, there are, in fact, 13 counties in Minnesota that have no access to advocacy services. You have heard from us previously that sexual assault is one of the most, if not the most, hidden crime in our communities. 1 in 4 females and 1 in 6 males we can expect will be assaulted sometime in their lifetime before they reach the age of 18. In Minnesota, the number of victims every year is large enough to fill the new TCF Stadium at the University of Minnesota and yet leave 20,000 people waiting at the gate. We're talking about a huge issue. Sadly, given that number, sadly, only 16 to 20% of victims ever seek help by reporting the crime to local law enforcement. Unless victims come forward, they are not able to access critical medical care to assess for injury, for illness, for disease, for pregnancy. They are not able to access equally critically supportive services and referral to help them through the short and long-term trauma that's related to sexual assault. Nor are they able to get help in understanding how the criminal justice system can be a resource for them. Because assaults that use sex as a tool of harm are perpetrated in and maintain such a cloak of secrecy, our ability to identify and hold offenders accountable depends often solely on the victim's brave act of reporting the crime. This is where advocacy programs make a difference. Advocates are skilled at understanding the fear, the concern, the confusion, and the betrayal that a victim of sexual assault may feel. They provide 24-hour services to women's, to teens, to children, to men, to elders in our communities, and to those people who support and care for those victims. Advocates ease the path to medical care, and they can help a victim understand the value of putting their lives on hold for a few, in fact, long hours as their bodies become the crime scene that is processed to collect evidence by forensic nurse examiners in emergency rooms. Advocates are especially trained to help victims access resources to keep them safe, to navigate the very complex criminal justice system, and to participate in the criminal investigation, which can last as often as long as 18 months to 2 years, and then also to navigate the court proceedings. I'd like to say, in fact, that that is the point at which most of the victims that our advocacy programs work with will connect then with an advocate within the prosecutor's office to access those services. I want to make sure that you know that there isn't a duplication between those services you heard about and the ones that our advocates provide. We work together hand in hand to ensure there isn't duplication. Well, these are sophisticated and complex services. In short, advocates are the community's safe space for a victim to test the waters, to understand whether or not they have the ability to break the silence about the crime against them, and for letting us know ultimately who the offenders are in our community. Unless victims speak, we don't know. These services and many others that I haven't addressed are rooted not only in simply good practice, but they are also required by the funder, the Office of Justice Programs, as part of the standards for advocacy. Most sexual assault programs, not unlike what you heard previously, do this work on very limited resource. The average grant to a sexual assault program to provide 24-hour-a-day countywide services every day of the year is $43,000. Again, you heard that's probably maybe enough to support one full-time equivalent position.
Ma'am,
how do they do it?
Yes,
I will end.
Here.
Okay. How do they do it? They really use this money to leverage volunteer services. Many of our programs can count as many as 2 to 3 full-time equivalencies in terms of the donated volunteer services to help support their work. Well, we have heard this committee debate and understand and be concerned about the challenges of holding sex offenders accountable, the growing concerns about budget, the struggle with the weight of these heinous crimes, and I'm just here to ask you to consider the importance of and the support of these community sexual assault advocates who are core partners in the community systems of public safety. I want to say briefly, we appreciate the direction that you're going regarding indeterminate sentencing, and we hope that the issues attendant to predatory offenders will be well taken care of. We hope that you also continue to look at low-level interventions, particularly the bill introduced by Representative McDonald, House File 660, as well as House File 532, which was introduced by Representative Kiefer. And we also hope that before advancing this bill, you will consider including the voice of a sexual violence survivor, victim survivor, on the task force. Thank you, Chair Cornish, and members of the committee for your good work in holding offenders accountable, supporting victim services, and hopefully amplifying the dialogue about prevention. I have invited Lauren Pilnick from Crime Victim Services to testify. I know that you don't probably have time for that, but I'd like you to know that she is here in case anybody has questions for her.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any questions? I'm sorry. No.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Commissioner Roy from the Department of Corrections, are you here? Welcome back. Good to see you again, and state your name and
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. Seated to my left is David Crist, Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. Good morning. Welcome. I always have to put my comments in context of where Minnesota falls in the national perspective in terms of correctional spending and our status in terms of our state prisons and our populations. And that context is very good. And you folks are going to get real tired of me saying this every time I see you. But I will remind you always that the context is that Minnesota is in very good shape when it comes to correctional issues, and especially in the area of prison populations and spending on correctional activities. I'm referencing very quickly a Pew report, 2009. Minnesota spends 2.6% of our general fund on correctional activities. The national average is 6.9. Similarly situated states have, it's not uncommon to have twice the correctional population in prisons and obviously twice the costs. My comments this morning will be in very general terms. And obviously, you folks have done a lot of work, and I compliment you for the thoughtfulness you put towards these correctional issues. One of the major importance on this budget, of course, is the replacement of the one-time funding for the federal stimulus money, and we are very appreciative of that, and certainly the governor has recognized it, as well as you folks have as well. The policy implications, we are obviously not prepared to discuss those today. We recognize that the studies that are included in this bill have pretty significant policy implications, and we're also very appreciative that during the first year of the biennium, you relaxed the cuts when it comes to those studies. And obviously, we would like time to produce those studies and prepare those as best we can and give you the best information possible to make policy studies or to make policy decisions. The timing of those studies is very important to us because there are some implications in terms of the budget here that some of those cuts may be effective the first portion of this biennium. And obviously our preference in very general terms is that the studies be completed before any major considerations are given to budget strategies. I will comment on several inclusions, and I'll be as brief as possible because I know you have people lined up behind me. There is some notion within the discussion in several items here that there are certain positions or certain business operations within the Department of Corrections that are not as important as the security function. But I just want to remind the committee members that corrections is a business. We have 9,600 residents in our facilities, 365 days a year. Our beds are full. They need to be fed, clothed, and all the operations to support those offenders in prison are obviously a business operation. So our fiscal responsibilities are significant. Our infrastructure is important to us, and we have a true belief that positions in the business function are not duplicative or redundant or wasteful positions. They are essential to our business operations. And just to remind committee members that a few years ago in our operations support budget, we did lose 27 positions. We are also concerned, certainly I need to comment on the important part of this proposal is the pension discussion regarding correctional personnel. And I need to also comment that the notion that prison personnel, not correctional officers, are not important to the function of the prison, or that those positions that are falling with this proposal falling outside of the pension system don't perform essential correctional activities and spend a majority of their time in high-risk situations with offenders in the prison. Teachers, work supervisors, caseworkers all spend very significant time with offenders and put themselves at risk for most of their shift. I mean, that's the reality of working in a prison. When that door slams behind you, everybody within that facility has the responsibility for security, and every one of those folks put themselves at some risk. And I think the risk, and I think the recognition of the pension system to that is very important, and I just needed to mention that. We have certainly a lot of concerns that the study groups that are proposed within this bill may or may not produce the outcomes in terms of fiscal savings that are predicted. And again, we would like the opportunity to complete those studies before any of those strategies are imposed. I'm going to look at Mr. Christ and ask if he has any additions. Mr. Chair, with your permission.
Just before you do, I got some questions for you. Commissioner, Was the pension bill that we're talking about the change in the governor's budget 2 years ago, and didn't the department support it then? Could you, anybody out there that could answer that you brought with you? Mr. Christ, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Christ. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Facilities. And I'll take a crack at that. A couple of years ago, under the Pawlenty administration, there was a proposal for pension changes. It wasn't exactly in this format, and it didn't go anywhere.
What was the department's position, the corrections?
The department supported the pension change at the time, as did the governor's administration. Again, it wasn't exactly, I believe, what is proposed here today.
And Commissioner, just, and I know you didn't mean it that way, but you termed it that we thought the positions weren't important. You said not important. That wasn't our intention at all, to say that those positions aren't important. And then the other thing is, you say losing positions. I don't know if corrections has actually suffered any people out the door yet when you say losing positions, or do you mean unfilled vacancies? I don't know the real tight figure on that one, but when you mentioned losing positions since such and such.
Mr. Chair, your analysis is correct that they were unfilled positions.
And then, let's see, what was the other one? On those loss of positions, or unfilled vacancies, I should say, how has that affected your overall efficiency or mission? Have you, in terms of your effectiveness or being able to fulfill your mission, are you still as effective as you used to, or is your effectiveness diminished and your performance not as good as it used to be? That's kind of a loaded question.
Mr. Chair, the question is a very fair question, and I will answer as honestly as I can. I believe we are accomplishing our mission, and I would suggest that by not filling those positions, very good employees have stepped up to the plate and taken on more workload. Some tasks are not completed in as timely a manner as we would hope, but I think the public and this committee should have confidence that we are meeting our mission.
Commissioner Chris. Oh, let's see. Representative Gauthier, you had a question first?
Yes, I did. Commissioner, on page 7, line 26 of the bill is juvenile facilities report. I have a couple of questions. A, how does a juvenile end up in Togo or Red Wing?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative, those placements are made out of the juvenile court in the judicial districts, and they come out of delinquency placements, not controlled, of course, by the Department of Corrections.
Give me an example, please.
Mr. Commissioner.
A youthful offender commits an assault on the streets of Duluth. He's petitioned into court by the county attorney. There's a finding of delinquency, and the court feels that for disposition of that case, the child should be placed in a facility to meet his needs. And sometimes those needs are treatment needs, and sometimes they're security needs, and sometimes they're a combination thereof.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
And sometimes it's to keep the public safe. Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruffy.
Commissioner, what is the vacancy rate at these programs?
Commissioner?
If you don't know, you can say that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am summoning my memory here, and I believe we are at $180 a day, thereabouts.
Okay.
Representative Gauthier.
I'm actually asking you what your occupancy rate is. How full are they?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier, the Togo program is averaging around 30 juvenile boys right now, 30, 32. The Red Wing program right now is hovering around 100 boys.
How many beds do you have?
The Red Wing program could accommodate more, upwards of 200.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Gauthier. Representative Mummery.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Crist, you said Red Wing could accommodate 200. We have adults in there also, aren't they? Are they using up part of that extra 100, or are they? Is that on top of that? And then another question on Togo. I thought there were juvenile girls in there also, or is that different?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, you're correct about Togo. We do have some a three-week wilderness program that does accommodate juvenile girls as well, but the other residential programs are for boys, so I overlooked that when I answered that question. Representative Mulry, we also have 30 women in the CIP program up at Togo who are referred there from Shakopee. As to there's about 45 men in a minimum security unit at Red Wing, and right now they're not cutting into our juvenile capacity because the juvenile population is down.
Representative Mulroy?
Sure, I'm still trying to. Are the 45 in addition, or are we still sitting with 100 empty there? And then the 45 are in something else, or the 45 or 50, whatever it varies, in the 100 over the juvenile?
Representative Mulroy, I believe there's capacity for another 100 or so juveniles at Red Wing.
Yes. And Representative Mulroy, that's one of the things we're wondering. That's why we want to give them some flexibility and direction if they want to close down one or both of them if they have to. Or well, good questions. Anybody on the list here? Any more from members here? Anything else you'd like to say, Mr. Crist or Commissioner?
A couple of quick things, Mr. Chair. Representative Mulroy, I've been corrected. The total capacity of Red Wing is about 180. And and those adults count against that capacity. So the other thing I'd like to speak to very quickly, Mr. Chair, is the governor's recommendation to fund the chemical dependency program at Faribault. That, as Mr. Carter indicated, that program runs out of its federal grant in December of this year. We will have to go from 180 chemical dependency beds there to 90 chemical dependency beds in that facility when the grant runs out if this funding is not provided. Chemical dependency programming in Minnesota prisons reduces recidivism by 30%. That's a significant thing. It will constitute cost avoidance into the future, and having fewer people in prison in the future and the public being safer if we fund these program beds at that facility. So if there's anything the committee can do to restore that that program funding, we would appreciate that. I would just echo the commissioner's thoughts of thanks to the committee for your hard work. You've had a difficult task. We appreciate the work you do.
Mr. Crist, the 30%, how do you quantify that? Is it, as we hear, the for every dollar you give us, you get 14 and a half back? I just want to know how you came up with that figure. Is that tracking the people from chemical dependency? Is it due just to the chemical dependency, or do they receive other job program or mingling with the civilian population or other things along with that?
Mr. Chair, there is a recent report published on our website by the DOC Research Department that compares participants in our programs to like individuals who have not participated in chemical dependency programs. They have controlled for as many of those other variables as they can.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, gentlemen, both of you. Yeah, Commissioner, you had something?
Mr. Chair, I need to also thank you folks for recognizing the importance of community services and community supervision. I think your support of that supervision in the community is very important, and I know Representative Mullery has been very vocal in that area, and I know other members have recognized this as well, that there's very important work going on in our communities, and we certainly appreciate your support of those activities. And on behalf of the other county correctional systems, I would thank you for that as well.
Thank you. You've been very open and honest with us as far as we can tell in all of our meetings, so appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
And then one thing I shouldn't forget, the Representative Mullery, I didn't make in my regular announcement that when you come with us for your amendments, they're going to have to be balanced to be considered in order, balanced within our target. So in other words, if you find an amendment where you're adding money, you have to tell us where it came from. So. Okay, next testifier would be Mr. Stewart from Public Defender.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. Wanted to thank you for putting out the effective date on the sex offender bill. I think that's a real good idea to have the task force figure out how to actually do this. My only comment is that the principle involved here involves a cost transfer from the counties to the state, in that the counties are paying for the legal services for people that are being committed as sex offenders now, because those are civil cases. By making it part of the criminal case, the state will be taking on that responsibility constitutionally for the representation of those folks. So I think in the long run, overall, this proposal will be cost-saving by saving costs in the long-term housing of the offenders. But meanwhile, the state will be picking up the costs of having those trials, which are big, major trials. And so we look forward to working with you to develop this and to flesh out some of those details.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you.
I'm hoping you're on that board, and I hope I get a spot, and together we'll work these problems out.
Thank you. I look forward to being on that. That'd be great.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Just on that point, the state already gets out of those on one thing. We have in law that we're supposed to pay until the hearing for them, and however, we've never funded except for 1 year. So state has ways of wiggling out even when we take responsibility.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Stewart.
You.
Sarah from the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to me. I'm a sexual assault advocate with the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center, and my program is almost entirely funded by the Office for Justice Program.
And Sarah, how do you say your last name?
El Fakahani. My mom's maiden name was Johnson.
Oh. Welcome. Where's your office, by the way?
It's in South Minneapolis by Franklin and Cedar.
Okay, you can go ahead, sorry.
I can assure you that I will be brief because I'm quite certain that I've gotten a parking ticket already. I wanted to speak to you about the importance of sexual assault advocacy programs and the threat that cuts to the Office for Justice Programs budget proposes. My agency is the only state-funded sexual assault program for American Indian women in urban areas. I am the only person in that program, which means I'm very busy every day. I see about, in the past 11 months, I've seen over 140 women. That doesn't mean that I've had 140 different times I've met with them. That means I've worked with 140 different women, so hundreds and hundreds of cases with women. And this is a subject very important to me because not only am I an advocate for survivors of sexual violence, but I am also a survivor. My mother is a survivor of sexual violence. My sister is a survivor of sexual violence. American Indian women experience sexual violence at a rate that's 3.5 times higher than the general population. The statistics for sexual violence in the Native American community range from between 1 in 3 women and 3 out of 4 women. I want to let you know that even though in the short term cost budget cuts to the Office for Justice program may seem beneficial, in the long term it will end up harming the community. The costs of sexual violence are astronomical. Survivors of sexual violence are 26 times more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol. They're 6 times more likely to contemplate suicide. They experience mental illness and post-traumatic stress disorder at a rate that's 7 times higher than the general population. All of these are costly not only to survivors of sexual violence, but to the taxpayers. I can say from personal experience, I've seen incredible growth and progress in clients that I've worked with. I've seen women who have gone from being suicidal to just being overjoyed at life. I've had numerous clients become sober after decades of drug use. I've had clients who had contemplated harming themselves or others decide that that wasn't necessary. I'm sorry, I get a little emotional about this. I was never able to face my attacker. My mother was never able to. My sister will never be able to. Unfortunately, we do not often have a justice system for victims. We have a system that benefits offenders. Where we see justice is when survivors have access to these programs where people will listen to them and advocate on their behalf, where they can bear their darkest secrets and their wounds and have someone listen with an open mind and an open heart. That is where we see justice for survivors of sexual violence. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
I'll give you a little time here, but I would like to ask you a couple of questions, ma'am. First of all, what's the line item that you receive? How much?
I'm sorry?
What's the line item that you receive? How much in the grant? How many dollars do you receive for your program?
$47,000.
Okay, and then what other sources of funding do you have in that program?
I have a minor grant through Hennepin County to do a sexual assault program at the Plymouth Workhouse.
Okay. Any help from any of the Indian communities, different tribal communities, reservations?
Unfortunately, most of the Indian communities are struggling with sexual violence in their own communities, so it's very limited. So while some reservations may have sexual assault advocates, I am the only advocate for American Indian women in urban areas, which is the majority of the Indian population in Minnesota.
Okay. Any questions from members? Thank you very much, ma'am, for your testimony.
Thank you.
We're probably going to quit today about 5:02 so we can get to session. But the next one on the report here, or on the sign-up sheet, is Kevin Lindsay from the Department of Human Rights. We might as well give you until 5:02, and then we'll adjourn. And Welcome. State your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kevin Lindsay. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. I had a question for the Chair, which may help me limit my comments. I believe earlier on when you were talking about the direction given to the Department as it relates to going forward is that you were limiting education and outreach activities of the Department, and that was the scope. Is that correct?
Yes.
And it wasn't broader than that?
Where's Mr. Deagle? I think in one place it said it limited you to enforcement activities. And then Mr. Deagle, could you restate the question to Mr. Oh, is it Rebecca? Could you restate the question for Mr.
Sure. Deagle? I just wanted to make sure that I understood sort of where the direction the committee was trying to direct the department. Is it to limit the education and outreach to eliminate that from the department?
Ms. Pierce?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, yeah, the writer on page 6 directs the commissioner to dedicate the department's resources to enforcement or the complaints. That's in the writer that would expire in the next 2 years, but there is also statutory changes going forward. And as the commissioner pointed out, those do take out all the education and program requirements in Section 3 of Article 2. And then there are changes also in Section 4 on contract compliance, which does not eliminate it. It raises the thresholds to lower the workload.
Okay.
If you go ahead and use your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically on that point, just to ensure that the committee understands, the department has received funding in the past from foundations. Specifically, we have a grant right now from the Otto Bremer Foundation. By taking out that specific statutory language within the Minnesota Human Rights Act, it would eliminate the ability for the department to be able to receive dollars from foundations. So to the extent that we were able to submit a grant to the McKnight Headwaters or a variety of different foundations within the state, we would be limited from receiving these dollars. It's a loss to the department and an opportunity for the state to leverage money that it could get from foundations to eliminate and eradicate discrimination within the state of Minnesota. So I ask the committee to think about that specific issue. Do we really wish to limit the ability from the department to be able to obtain these grant dollars from foundations within the state? I'm not prepared to discuss all of the policy implications as it relates to it. I will follow up in writing to all the members of the committees. But that one, when I sat and listened to it and looked at the specific language, that jumped out at me. That may have been an unintended consequence. Specifically, the chair mentioned earlier on that there was duplication. I guess I want to make sure that the committee understands that there's actually not duplication between federal resources. First off, the federal government, as relates under the Americans with Disabilities Act, it begins at 50 employees. So every employer that employs less than 50 employees in the state of Minnesota would not be covered by the ADA. The enforcement there would happen under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. More than half the employers in the state of Minnesota aren't going to be reached by the ADA. So a significant portion of employers all of a sudden are not going to be covered. And then when we talk about the joint work share agreement between the EEOC and the Minnesota Human Rights Act, what we're really then talking about is the respective agencies coming together and then making a determination as to which resources are going to be utilized by those respective agencies. It's important to acknowledge and look at sort of the direction in which the federal government has gone with the EEOC. And that is that the federal government has given more resources to look at systemic large class action discrimination cases. So for those employers that have more than 50 employees in the state of Minnesota as it's targeted under the ADA or the federal law, we're really now having the federal government look at only large-scale systemic discrimination classes. One-off, two employees, three-employee cases are not going to be taken by the federal government. that's going to have a significant impact as it relates to discrimination charges and the enforcement of those within the state of Minnesota. That's going to have a significant impact. As it relates to the city of St. Paul and the city of Minneapolis, it is true that they do have a human rights department, but they do not have the resources to go beyond the jurisdiction of those cities. So again, when we look at, are there at the local level human rights departments who could step up and then fill that gap? The answer is no. The Minnesota Human Rights Department is critical and pivotal to addressing those respective discrimination charges in the area of employment. It's also important to recognize that for the Minnesota Human Rights Department and under the Human Rights Act, our scope is broader than just employment. While it is true the majority of the current cases pending before the Minnesota Human Rights Department are employment-related cases, that's not the scope and the entirety of our jurisdiction. We address other issues of discrimination which are very important.
Are you able to come back tomorrow and start off where you left off? Or do you want to just finish up like in a minute and then come back tomorrow? We'll give you another 5 minutes for your other testifier too. So.
I don't believe Mr. Hernandez was going to testify, but I, understanding having chaired a lot of meetings and a need to get to other things within the day, I would welcome the opportunity to come back and then speak to the entire committee so that you can get to other matters that you need to attend to.
And then what happened to you the other day? We called your office and told you that Bill was going to be up. You would have had a lot more time to address it, but
I was speaking with senators in the other chamber, in the Senate. Unfortunately, I have not been able to figure out how to be in two places at one time, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But I appreciate you making the time available to me at this time.
You bet. And come back tomorrow, we'll give you 5 more minutes.
That sounds great.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if there's no questions, anybody? Meeting adjourned.